Just so, hello, welcome to our final session three of day one. Congratulations for making it all the way through. Strong work, team. My name's Ellie, my pronouns are she, and I'm going to be your chair for the session today. What would be really great is if you are sitting on the very edge of the rows, if you could like move in towards the middle so that people who come late don't have to like clamber over other people, that would be fantastic. So if you're on the very edge and there are empty seats next to you, if you could move in a little bit, I'm sure we don't all bite, everyone's going to be fine. That'd be great, there we go. So then there's space on the edge for people who come late. Okay, so our session today is about erasure and inclusivity in archival and historical practice. And we have three really fantastic talks for you. Each of the talks is going to be 20 minutes long. And then at the end, we're going to have a half an hour session for discussion with all three of our panelists. So what I would recommend you do is if you do have any questions during the session, write it down on a piece of paper. We have these lovely books. Grab a pen, note down your question, and then we can ask them at the end. Okay, so I would like you to all join me in welcoming our first speaker to the stage. Unfortunately, only one of the two advertised people is here today. We have Brett Lougheed here to represent both himself and Albert MacLeod. So can I have a big round of applause, please, for his Two Spirit Rising, overcoming the archival erasure of Two Spirit People of Canada. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellie, and thanks very much, everybody, for allowing me to share with you today. I have to say I'm not a big fan of this template, but it's titled Berlin, so I thought, when else am I going to use this one? So I'd like to begin by acknowledging that I'm going to be speaking about a community to which I am an ally, but to which I do not personally identify. I am what we in Canada refer to as a colonial settler, someone who is implicitly responsible for the harms that past and current generations have imposed on Indigenous people in Canada through the colonization of Indigenous land and the attempted assimilation of Indigenous people through such horrific tactics that the Canadian government now acknowledges as genocide. I am not Indigenous. I am not queer. I am a white, heterosexual, cisgender Christian male. It is my community that has yielded power and authority in Canada for many centuries since the British and the French discovered my country and fought each other to impose their will on its original inhabitants. This power dynamic has continued to this day as people who do not look, act, or behave like me have been marginalized in Canadian society and purposefully erased from our documentary heritage. I acknowledge this fact, and I also acknowledge my responsibility as a member of this offending community to do the work to redress these injustices. My work in developing a Two-Spirit Archives at my place of employment, the University of Winnipeg, is my contribution to the ongoing reconciliation efforts now underway in Canada. The goal of this initiative is to assist in overcoming the archival erasure of Two-Spirit people in Canada by centering them in our institution's collection policy to improve their visibility in the record, to fill those intended gaps in Canada's documentary heritage, and to further research and discourse in the propagation of Two-Spirit culture, history, and heritage. Many of you today may not be familiar with the term Two-Spirit. In my conversations with Two-Spirit people and my research over the years, I have come to understand that there is not one standard definition of Two-Spirit. Two-Spirit is a subjective term and means something different to everyone who identifies with this term. I am not two-spirited, so I tend to shy away from defining the term. My co-presenter, Albert MacLeod, a two-spirit activist and original contributor to the Two-Spirit Archives, was going to define two-spirit and provide remarks about the past and present history of two-spirit people, but he unfortunately could not secure the funding to attend the conference. With Albert's blessing, I will use the definition provided by the Assembly of First Nations resolution creating the Two Spirits in Motion Foundation, that defines Two-Spirit as a term used to describe, and I quote, Indigenous people who assume cross or multiple gender roles, attributes, dress, and attitudes for personal, spiritual, cultural, and ceremonial reasons. These roles are defined by each cultural group and can be fluid over a person's lifetime. Modern terms like gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, and intersexed in combination with or exclusive to Two-Spirit, may be adopted by some Indigenous people to define who they are, end quote. The one constant that remains true is that it is a term created by and applied to Indigenous people only. The term's origins lie in our home province of Manitoba. It was first introduced in 1990 at the third annual LGBT Native American gathering in Beauséjour, Manitoba, just outside of Winnipeg. The term came to local elder Myra Laramie, who is pictured in the center, in a vision, and it was adopted at the gathering as a spirit name. Today, Two-Spirit has been widely adopted in North America and around the world by the community. Prior to colonization, Two-Spirit people were highly revered within Indigenous society. Many Indigenous languages have words to describe gender beyond the binary of male and female. Two-Spirit people were fully integrated into Indigenous social structures, often assuming both male and female roles, such as medicine keepers and healers, counselors, caregivers, artists, cooks, hunters, and stewards of oral traditions. They were traditionally considered to be highly intellectual, artistic, and compassionate, and were considered gifts to their communities from the Creator. They enjoyed a position of privilege within communities for hundreds of years until these communities were exposed to the Eurocentric, homophobic worldviews forcefully perpetuated by their French and English colonizers. Two-Spirited people did not conform to this worldview and as such were early targets for erasure. In Canada, the erasure of Two-Spirit people coincided with the introduction of Christianity. Missionaries were sent to Indigenous communities to spread the word of God in an effort to assimilate Indigenous people into Western culture and traditions. They were told that their culture, language, and beliefs were unnatural and immoral, and that they should adopt those of their colonizers for a better, righteous way forward. Heteronormative behavior was encouraged amongst Indigenous communities, and Two-Spirit people were suddenly ostracized and shamed within their own communities. This belief system was further reinforced with the advent of the Indian residential school system. Churches and the government conspired to forcibly remove Indigenous children from their families and their communities and place them in residential schools to learn Western traditions, language, and systems of knowledge. These children often had no contact with their families and were frequently physically and sexually abused. The residential school system was responsible for the deaths of thousands of children at the hands of their educators, suicide, or the results of attempted escapes. The generational effects of this system have been devastating to Indigenous people as residential school survivors and their families try to cope with the trauma inflicted upon them without the requisite supports of the government. Rates of alcoholism, drug abuse, homelessness, and violence are disproportionately high amongst Indigenous people in Canada. The 60s scoop, where Indigenous children were again taken from their families against their will and placed in foster care or adoption, further added to the trauma imposed upon Indigenous people. The report of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Residential Schools referred to this practice as cultural genocide. The recently completed inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls also referred to Canada's treatment of Indigenous people as genocide, a statement that was supported by the Prime Minister. In 2017, the Canadian government officially apologized for suppressing Two-Spirit Indigenous values and beliefs. For Two-Spirit people, the effects of colonization were devastating. Two-Spirit people no longer held privileged positions within Indigenous communities. Some decided to hide their sexuality or gender and live a heterosexual, cisgendered lifestyle in order to be accepted by their families and friends. Many were forced to leave their communities, find refuge in cities, and abandon their traditional language and customs. Many Two-Spirit people continued to face persecution within the non-Indigenous LGBTQ communities in larger cities, where the racial and spiritual aspects of the Two-Spirit identity were often considered confusing and ignored. Others committed suicide, not being able to live with their true selves in a society that would not accept them for who they were. A report of the National Aboriginal Health Organization claimed that Two-Spirit people were more likely to experience violence than heterosexual Indigenous people, and were twice as likely to experience assault than non-Indigenous LGBTQ people. The Urban Native Youth Association reported that 38% of Two-Spirit youth didn't feel accepted in their communities, 43% suffered from depression, and 34% thought about or attempted suicide and were more likely to become dependent on alcohol or drugs. The systemic marginalization and erasure of Two-Spirit people from Canadian society is not surprisingly reflected in the documentary heritage preserved in Canadian archives. The practice of library and archival science has traditionally been the realm of the privileged and powerful. Archives have been complicit in the erasure from the documentary record of segments of society that do not conform to the established Western historical narrative of Canada that has developed through academic and popular discourse over time, that of a colonial, cisgendered, heterosexual, white, male Canada. Archivists and record keepers have supported this narrative through the documentary neglect of records pertaining to racialized, indigenized, and queer communities. Two-spirited people are not highly visible when conducting a search of Canadian archival holdings. A Google search for Two-Spirit in archives yields very little relevant information. The Manitoba Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Manitoba claims to house textual material pertaining to Two-Spirit people. However, a search of the collection at a file level yields no records specifically mentioning the term Two-Spirit. The Wikipedia page for Two-Spirit includes a section on archival resources, which lists three collections, which to my observation have very little to do with Two-Spirit people other than the odd subject file or publication. A search for Two-Spirit in the archives section of the online catalog of Library and Archives Canada yields no relevant results, as does a search in the catalog of the Archives of Manitoba. A search of the Manitoba Archival Information Network and Archives Canada, the union catalog of archival descriptions for most repositories in Manitoba and Canada respectively, produce one hit, the aforementioned Manitoba Gay and Lesbian Archives, outside of the materials comprising the University of Winnipeg's Two-Spirit Archives. My most excellent colleagues at the Archives, Canada's LGBTQ2+ Archives, and the Transgender Archives at the University of Victoria, do include Two-Spirit people in their mandates. While they have made great efforts to include Two-Spirit people in their programming and outreach, they remain marginalized within the broader scope of their missions and within the records themselves. A search of the Archives' online holdings yields 110 records, mostly individual items. This search result represents only 0.1% of all the records available in its database. A search of the Transgender Archives yields mentions of books and periodicals pertaining to Two-Spirit people, but they are not explicitly visible in the archival holdings. The recent acquisition of the records of Ayanna Miracle, an Indigenous multidisciplinary artist, scholar, educator, story crafter, and storyteller who self-identified as a, quote, transformed woman who loves women, will make Two-Spirit people more visible in that archives. This marginalization, almost near omission of Two-Spirit people from institutional archives in Canada, is indeed a reflection of a society that has not only pushed Two-Spirit people to its margins, but has made concerted efforts to erase them completely. However, despite these intentional efforts to rid itself of non-conforming elements, Canada's genocidal assimilation experiment has failed. Indigenous people survived. Two-Spirit people survived. And we are now seeing a resurgence of culture, tradition, and language that many thought or even hoped would be lost over time. Coinciding with this renaissance of Indigenous communities, archivists are now beginning to work with these communities as allies to overcome archival silences and to make archives culturally safe spaces. The Steering Committee on Canada's Archives has established the response to the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission Task Force, whose goals are to conduct a review of archival policies and best practices in Canada, identify barriers to reconciliation between Western and Indigenous record keepers, and work with Indigenous communities to formulate a reconciliation framework for Canadian archives. A survey of Canadian archives by this group indicated that 11% of respondents were able to identify ongoing relationships with Indigenous communities or organizations, while over half acknowledged the importance of consulting, partnering, and building relationships with them. We at the University of Winnipeg Archives are working with members of the local Two-Spirit community to combat their archival erasure through the stewardship of the Two-Spirit Archives, a multimedia collection documenting the Two-Spirit movement and its peoples in Manitoba and throughout North America. While rich in subject matter, the collection totals just over three boxes. Despite its minimal volume, it is still believed to be the most comprehensive collection of material on Two-Spirit people in Canadian archives. This is the indisputable evidence of the archival erasure of Two-Spirit people in Canada. It is the goal of the university and the Two-Spirit community with which we work to develop the Two-Spirit Archives into an internationally renowned center for research that supports the needs of the community and increases its visibility in our documentary heritage. The Two-Spirit Archives origins lie in a donation of records from Albert MacLeod in 2011 that colloquially became known as the Two-Spirit Collection. MacLeod, a Cree Métis elder and knowledge keeper, has been an advocate for the rights of Two-Spirit and queer people in Manitoba and across Canada for over 40 years. He has worked with LGBTQ Indigenous people in North America to organize under the name Two-Spirit and is considered a pioneer in HIV education for Indigenous people. He has engaged in human rights activism, cross-cultural training, cultural reclamation, and language workshops, and has served as an advisor and activist for Winnipeg's inner-city community. He is also the founder and co-director of Two-Spirited People of Manitoba. He is well-respected within his community and was awarded an honorary Doctor of Laws at last year's University of Winnipeg convocation ceremonies for his tireless contributions to society. He is an amazing person, and you are all lesser off not being able to hear from him today. What is now known as the Albert MacLeod Foam is the material that he has collected or created through his work as an advocate and his life as a Two-Spirit person. The foam consists of newsletters, journals, magazines, reports, newspaper clippings, correspondence, poetry, digital and print photographs, posters, art, textiles, books, digital and analog video, and other ephemera that document the Indigenous Two-Spirit movement in Manitoba and throughout North America. Albert continues to add to his foam with frequent accruals. The uniqueness of the Two-Spirit collection became evident to me when I became university archivist 4.5 years ago. Researchers from all over North America made inquiries and booked research trips to browse through this tiny body of records, as it was the primary record set in Canada documenting the history and the resurgence of Two-Spirit people. I attempted to build further interest in the collection by promoting it through exhibitions, presentations, news media, and inclusion in the Society of American Archivists' Lavender Legacy Guide and the Digital Transgender Archive. But there was mutual desire between the archives and Albert to build upon his archival legacy and develop the collection into something more that would benefit the university and the Two-Spirit community. Last summer, the archives hired an archival studies student, Coral Baish, to consult with Two-Spirit elders and help draft a strategic plan for the development of a Two-Spirit archives. Out of this plan evolved our three-pronged mission for the Two-Spirit archives: to develop an internationally renowned research collection that supports the needs of the Two-Spirit community, to center and make visible Two-Spirit people in our documentary heritage, and to support the research, teaching, learning, and community mandates of the university. Our mission objectives are to have Two-Spirit people lead collection development, increase the size and usage of the Two-Spirit archives, and embed the archives into research and instruction on campus and around the world. We've started work in earnest on achieving our objectives. We have established a Two-Spirit Archives Advisory Group consisting of Albert, myself, and three other members of the Two-Spirit community that provides leadership and guidance in the development of the archives and ensures that Two-Spirit people are central to preserving the history of their contributions to society and in strengthening their community. We assisted in the facilitation of an oral history project at last year's annual International Two-Spirit Gathering, whereby Two-Spirit people were provided with training by our Oral History Center, after which they designed the project, including the interview questions and consent forms, conducted the interviews, and assisted in the archiving. This summer, we will begin the process of transcribing and uploading those interviews. We have established an Indigenous stewardship agreement that authorizes the transfer of stewardship over materials to the university, but ownership of the materials is retained by the original Indigenous steward. We have uploaded digitized content online through the creation of a Two-Spirit Archives digital collection, and we revised our website to include space for the Two-Spirit Archives in an effort to promote wider usage of the collection. We will continually add to both the digital collection and the website, and we have started to add additional records to the archives, including video proceedings and posters and programs for the recent C2C, Two-Spirit and Queer People of Color Call to Conversation with LGBT and Allies conference held at the University of Winnipeg, and the records of Connie Morasti, a Two-Spirit actor and drag performer. Last month, during Winnipeg's Pride Week, the Archives hosted the official launch of the Two-Spirit Archives in our latest attempt to draw attention to the collection. The event followed the annual raising of both the Pride and Two-Spirit flags on the front lawn of our downtown campus. Approximately 45 people were in attendance, where they had the opportunity to hear from Albert, Connie, and I about the archives, browse through some of the material that was on display, and watch a highlight video from the C2C conference that nicely encapsulated the challenges and joys of being two-spirited. Local news media attended the event, and we were picked up nationally by the CBC on its website. The event was a tremendous success and achieved our goal of promoting the archive more widely. The stories in the media were shared widely on social media, requests to view the materials were received the following day, and potential contributors to the archives came forward with the intent to donate their materials. The Two-Spirit Archives Advisory Committee was invigorated by the success of the event and are keen to continue with the work. While we have accomplished much in the past year, there is so much more to do in order to realize our vision for the Two-Spirit Archives. Our three-year strategic plan for the development of the archives includes implementing Indigenous traditional knowledge protocols into our work, advocating for greater representation of Two-Spirit people in the archival profession, encouraging further donations through the creation of outreach materials, creating additional digital content, including web archives, identifying and actively informing potential user groups within and external to the university community, and embedding the material into the curricula of relevant disciplines. Our hope is that over the next few years, under the leadership and guidance of the Two-Spirit Advisory Council, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we can assist and contribute to the resurgence of this community and the reassumption of their rightful place of inclusion, equality, respect, and reverence in Canadian society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to welcome to the stage next Yenar Bayram Molo, and he's going to be talking about queer voices and archives in Istanbul and Berlin. Please give him a big round of applause.
So, hello everyone, I'm Yenar Bayramoğlu. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Ali Solomon University here in Berlin. But today I'm not going to talk about my current project, but about a project which is finished and also published. I'm going to talk about my dissertation, which I wrote at the Freie Universität Berlin in Media Studies Department. And I defended it, I think, 3 years ago. And it was published as a book last year. So my PhD thesis was on the history of queer representations in Turkish and German tabloids. Yes, tabloids. So it's a, you know, one might argue that we won't find queer histories in tabloids. But I will talk about it in a bit more in detail and also about the meaning of conducting research on tabloids. But before that, I would like to talk about my own affective relationship with the history or with the past or with the archives. By saying that, I would like to cite Heather Love, who was very influential for my work. She writes in her book and asks this question, why we as queer scholars are obsessed with the question whether there are queer people in the past. And so I picked up for this presentation two of the central questions. Why do we care so much if there were queer people in past or not? What relations with these past figures do we hope to cultivate? So these questions are central for her, but they also kind of pushed me to think about my own relationship with the archive and with the research that I did. And I started thinking about what were the possible reasons for that. And I had to remember my own activistic work during Lambda Istanbul. For those of you who don't know about Lambda Istanbul, it's the first and even the oldest LGBT organization in Turkey, which was established in 1993. as a protest when the Istanbul municipality banned the Pride March attempts. And so I was a volunteer at the Lambda Istanbul, and my duty was to reorganize the archive and also to add new material to the archive. And this archive was basically a collection of newspaper articles. So it was, so to say, the first moment of me encountering the material that I would keep on analyzing during my PhD. And it was also a very interesting moment because I ended up realizing how things that we consider so obvious change in such a short time. And but for my PhD, I decided to get out of Lambda Istanbul's safe archives and go to the places where you would not necessarily expect finding queer histories. So one of the places that I visited, or I spent my months in researching, was Istanbul Atatürk Kitaplığı. So it's probably one of the biggest libraries in Istanbul, and it has a really huge press archive. It was established in 1920s and then moved to this beautiful modern building in 1981. It is a really nice view over Bosporus, so it was a nice experience doing there my research. And so I spent there probably my 5 months reading everyday tabloids. And another place that I stopped by during my research was the Zeitungsarchiv der Staatsbibliothek zu Berlin. This is the press archive in Berlin. So when we talk about the effective relationship with the archives, we need to also talk about the horrifying experience of being in the middle of the silence. And with silence, I don't necessarily mean the silence that surrounds the rooms and the architecture of the libraries or the archives, but it is the silence that comes up, emerges from the archive itself. Particularly if you conduct an archive research in places which are not designed to document queer histories, what you encounter is most of the time silence. So untold stories, silenced queer ancestors, erased visibilities. These are the things and experiences that fulfills these places. And so I spent my days and weeks with the hope to find any traces of queer history in these archives. And most of the time, what I found was actually this silence. And I argue, instead of looking away and thinking only about the visibilities or the voices, we need to also start theorizing about the silence as part of a queer experience, also about, you know, invisibilities, also these voids in the history. I think these are definitely part of the queer experience. The silence, this invisibility, occurs again and again as a shared and time-spanning isolation between queer subjects in different times and places. Nevertheless, it seems analytically difficult to fully grasp the gaps, the voids, the silence. The dilemma is that the gaps, the silence, the invisibility can only be analyzed on the basis of their representations, on the basis of the figures that are represented in the realm of the visible and the speakable. We can analytically document queer silence and the invisibility only through the distorted and deformed voices that reach us in the present. Although my work presents an analysis of the text in which some kind of representations of queer subjects emerge, most of the archives are simply characterized by non-representation or silence. And in this moment, one might also, you know, pose the question, why on earth should we do archive research in such places which are doomed for silence? Or why on researching on top tabloids which are, you know, full of misrepresentation or negative representation? And I think this was also, by the way, one of the critics that I got in the beginning of my PhD. And I think this question and this critic is pretty much linked with the idea that we need to shift our attention from sad moments into happy moments. Sara Ahmed talks about that. And as part of this narrative, tabloids or negative portrayals are very often ignored. But I argue, if we would like to rewrite history, we need to make peace with those moments or representations in history that kill our joy. Particularly, it is the case for places like Turkey, where there are not enough studies or research on queer history. Tabloids are really vivid places. It's full with queer stories and queer representations. So you need to make peace with that kind of representations in order to able to write the history. But my research was not only a historical research, but I wanted also to compare two different countries, Turkey and Germany, two different archival histories. And my idea by doing this was to question this typical dichotomy between Orient and Occident. There's this assumption that Orient is not the place where you would not find queer histories. It is the place that would not give a space for queer existence. So I wanted to question that. And I wanted also to question the linear perception of the time. There's linear perception of the linear progression from repression to liberation, which is a very central meaning for most of the Western philosophy tradition. And I wanted also to pose the question, can we talk about an universal queer history at all? What are the temporal breaks in queer histories in Turkey and Germany? So these were, so to say, the central questions that directed my archive research. And but thankfully, I mean, after spending days and weeks, suddenly some stories started to emerge. And so I will try to quickly give some of the interesting examples in order to represent one of the central arguments of my book. So in the late 90s, I think this was 1969, so it's one of the stories is like the story of Bedriye Gül. Bedriye Gül, here she's called as Erkek Bedriye, is represented as a tomboy. We see her here on the left in men's outfit and on the right as women's outfit. And it's a very interesting story because Bedriye Gül kidnaps a newly married woman named Kadriye. And it's very interesting because you hear also her voice in the text. Bedriye Gül makes her statement to the police and explains why she wears men's clothes. Until I was 14 years old, I put on skirts, constant sexual harassment, etc. There were dozens of them. From the age of 14, I put on trousers and I gained my freedom. My older sister, who saw this, also wore trousers. Much later, we dressed completely in men's clothing and thus freed ourselves completely from the men. I did not kidnap Kadriye in bad faith. The girl was tired of her life. She wanted to see relatives in Izmir. I helped her to free herself. So it was not only a queer story, it was definitely also a feminist story. We see two women showing solidarity with each other. And when I started encountering with such stories that were circulated in tabloids, my perception of tabloids also started to change. I think particularly when we talk about 1960s and 1970s, and particularly when we talk about Turkey, tabloids were the only medium where such stories was possible to circulate. Serious media, like serious newspaper, for them these stories were too pervert, too abnormal. So it was this violent interest of tabloids for gender identities and sexualities that do not comply with the norms that gave the place for such visibility. Another counterstone story that I can give an example from the German archives is the story of Judy Anderson and Marion Innes, and I'm sure some of you know the story. Judy Anderson and Marion Innes, they were a lesbian couple, and they were accused to murder the husband of Marion Innes. And it's a very interesting story because they had also a contract killer who was gay. So we see two lesbians and one gay man collaborating together and killing a heterosexual man. So it was a big scandal for Bild-Zeitung, and Bild-Zeitung started publishing a very long actually 2 months long article series in 1973 and one year later also in 1974 on this issue. And so it was called The Verbrechen der lesbischen Frauen. It can be translated as The Crimes of Lesbian Women. And it was a bunch of stories of different characters, but Marion Innes and Judy Anderson's story played a central role in this series. And it was clearly problematic. It was Bild Zeitung showed being lesbian as inherently able to be, conduct a crime. But on the other hand, I think we need to also see what this article series and what this kind of representation caused in the history. Because of Bild Zeitung's problematic representation, there was the first ever lesbian demonstrations that happened in Germany. So we can clearly see a Foucaultian relationship between the power, between the visibility, and the counter-discourse. And this is a typical narrative or typical pattern that repeats in the archive as well as in Germany, but also in Turkey. And I will give now another example from Turkey. From 1980s. Like in 1980s, from the material that I gathered from the archives from 1980s, I observed the similar pattern. 1980s were particularly politically turbulent time in Turkey because of the military coup that took place in 1980. And like many communities, many oppositional groups suffered from this military coup. And one of them was definitely the queer communities. And Bülent Ersoy, we see here two images of Bülent Ersoy. She's a very well-known trans singer, and she went through gender reassignment operation in 1980. It overlapped with the military coup. And after that, she was not allowed to go into stage because there was a ban against all the queer performers. And there were also some deportations, like queer communities were deported to small cities. And there were like constant police raids in the neighborhoods where trans and queer communities existed. So it was like the 1980s were shaped by this constant state violence and also the public shaming that tabloids try to succeed. And but again, this Foucaultian kind of relationship happened in 1980s in Turkey as well. The first ever demonstration that took place in Turkey was in 1987, and it was actually a protest against the state violence, but also against the public shaming of the tabloids and the newspapers. So I come with this three examples. I come to this central argument, which is a central meaning in my book. In most cases, when heteronormative discourses become too powerful and restrict queer lives too forcefully, fissures start to form in the public domain. Through these fissures, new forms of visibilities come to the surface. Whenever authoritarianism or heteronormity try to scandalize, pathologize, or illegalize queer subjects, queers work to create new spaces for queer visibility that did not previously exist. So this is one of the central arguments of my book. And so to summarize and to show also some of the concluding remarks, we need to do more research on silences, voids, and invisibilities as part of a queer history, which I address in the beginning of my talk. Scandalizing, criminalizing, pathologizing representations open up the possibility for new forms of queer visibilities which did not exist in public before. This is a pattern that I observed in my archive research. Another pattern was normalizing representations in tabloids have the tendency to tame the political demands of queer subjects. And these patterns can be observed similarly in German and Turkish archives. Therefore, we need to keep on questioning the dichotomies, typical dichotomy between Orient and Occident. Thank you very much.
Uh, Thank you, Yana. And I'd like to invite our final speakers to the stage, please. We have Dotan Brom and Yoav Zalritsky. Yes, been practicing. And they're going to be talking on living archives on inclusivity and ethics in queer oral history projects with relation to a specific oral history project they're going to tell us about. So please, a round of applause for them coming to the stage.
I ruined the place. Just one moment. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe we should come closer.
Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dotan. This is Yoav, and we are from the Haifa Queer History Project. Thank you all for coming and for this wonderful sharing. So for the past 3 years, we have been researching the queer history of our city, Haifa, a mixed city of Jews and Arabs located on the northern coast of Israel-Palestine. In our work, we are creating, together with another team member and a few part-time volunteers, a repository of LGBT plus experience, existence, and resistance in Haifa, mainly through the conduction of video-recorded interviews and the collection of archival material. We have so far conducted 16 interviews, 7 of them with men, 9 with women. All men identify as gay, 6 of the women identify as lesbians, and 3 of them identify on the trans spectrum. 14 interviewees identify as Jewish and or Israeli, and 2 identify as Palestinian. Our interviewees range in age from 44 to 72. Our growing archive consists, next to these video-recorded conversations, of documents that were donated by informants, contemporary items and materials from LGBT plus and queer activities that took place in Haifa, and representations of LGBT plus figures or themes we actively seek and collect in old media. All in all, the archive encompasses histories ranging from the early 1950s to the present. Next to our archival efforts, our project also deals with making these histories accessible to the public. We regularly guide walking tours, give lectures, and maintain a constant presence in social media while working towards launching a website. The crowning glory of our effort to make queer history more accessible and present is our annual Haifa Queer History Festival. Make sure you attend next year. When we founded the Haifa Queer History Project in 2015, we had an aspiration to amplify voices that were marginalized in the history of our country and our city, and to create a platform for the local queer community to get to know and reclaim its past. We viewed ourselves, and to a great extent still do, as activists more than academic scholars, or at least as trying to mount the academic carriage to the horses of social change. Much like other projects of public history around the world, we wanted our community to take an active role in the process of writing and narrating its past, and we wished to dismantle the power structures between us, the initiators of this project, and the queer community in Haifa.
Inclusivity was and still is a core value in our project for several reasons. Ethically, we believe that every community is entitled to collective memory. Politically, knowing that being erased from the national and local collective memory doesn't only reflect uneven power structures, but also contributes to that inequality We think that familiarizing oneself with one's collective history is an effective tool in community building and social justice struggles. And academically, we believe that a complex and thorough account of any given society cannot be completed without the histories of groups who are at the margins of society, or groups that defy societal norms. Now, after 3.5 years of work, we wish to go back and re-examine that initial aspiration based on the works that we have managed to do so far. We choose to share this introspection here with all of you because we think that our project might be a useful case study for other projects of similar nature, or even for any queer public history research project. We also wish to better our methods, and for that aim, we would like to invite you to take part in inspecting the limitations and boundaries of our own work. We will specifically focus on boundaries and limitations that evoke from generational fault line between us as interviewers and some of our interviewees. So, our archival work is striving for inclusiveness in two key aspects. First, we're aspiring to create an archive based on a diverse collection of testimonies and sources that express different life stories. While looking for interviewees, we've published a call for testimonies in Hebrew, Arabic, and Russian. As Dutan has mentioned, we so far made efforts to diversify our interviewees in terms of gender, sexual identity, and ethnicity, nationality. A second aspect is that we're making significant efforts to make our archival material more accessible and to invite the local community to form different narratives out of the materials that we have collected. In spite of these efforts to include more voices in our archive, many voices clearly remain outside of it. Every historical work is filled with silences, as you addressed so accurately, and is limited in its ability to present the past as it really was. Nonetheless, we wish to turn our gaze toward our archival collection process and inspect its limitations and boundaries. To understand them, we will start by examining the relationship between interviewers and interviewees through the metaphor of negotiation.
A relationship between an interviewee and an interviewer is based on different wants and needs and has some characteristics of a mutual give and take. Each side participating gains something from the interview and gives something in return. Let's examine this exchange in our work. So, what do we actually offer an interviewee? First of all, publicity. Somewhat in the general public, but mainly within the queer community, in which this public exposure can be translated into social status. We also offer a sense of value, legitimacy, and historical importance, a stronger sense of belonging to a community, and a stronger, more immediate sense of contribution and benefit to the public.
So, on the other side, what do we receive from the interview? So, first of all, clearly information. We find that we get specifically two main types of information, two different kinds. One is information about himself or herself, including his or her biographical narrative. And a different kind of information is historical urban maps of queer activities and queer sociabilities. Other than that, we also get legitimacy from our interviewee. If a person is interviewed for our project, it labels the project as a safe space for others to do the same and contribute their stories and materials. We also get a sense of belonging and a personal sense of value. The interviews make us feel that we belong to a multi-generational community and that we contribute to it in some way. In some cases, we cannot provide a potential interviewee anything that is of value to him or her. In other cases, the price which we are demanding is way too high, like an unwanted exposure to the public, a fear of an uncomfortable narrative, participation in a project that is perceived as dangerous or as inappropriate, etc. In all of these cases, we presume that our potential interviewee would rather not to partake in our project. Underlying the values at the basis of this negotiation aids us in looking more clearly at the identity, background, and needs of those who choose to remain outside of our reach.
We now wish to caricaturize those who are absent from our archive. We suggest two categories of potential interviewees who are currently unrepresented or underrepresented in it. In many ways, they define the archive's boundaries. The first category is of those who we know of their existence but chose not to be interviewed. This first category includes individuals who we know of their existence but are unable to attract them to share their stories. The most common cases in this category are those in which a certain individual or a group that had status as local activists in a particular point in time perceives our work or archival work as posing a threat to their personal collective narrative. The threat can originate from the fact that we have not yet reached out to this person or group, thus creating the impression of exclusion from the historical narrative. For example, this is a Facebook message that I got from such a person. I will translate it for you in English. Hi, Dotan, how are you? I was glad to get your invitation for the gay festival in Haifa. This is not the actual name of the festival. But I was somewhat sad that you did not count me in this time, like last time. I've written about Binyamin Garden, about gays in Haifa in the 50s and 60s. I write about our community in my books and my art. It's interesting, you pretend to admire the gay past of the city, but tend to forget people like me, artists and writers from the community. It's so very jarring, I have no words. These words come from pain and disappointment, really.
In other cases, we might have already mentioned an individual or a collective in one of our publications, but the image portrayed by us was viewed as an incorrect representation of their activity, thus rendering our archival work as distorted or even oppressive. For example, a message that I have received this year. Hi, dear Yoav, my name is X. In past times, I was very active within the LGBT community in Haifa, and the thing is that I am responsible for a lot of its important history. I founded the biggest ever group for the gay community, only boys. Every meeting had 40 people minimum. Many couples emerged from that group. It was a very big success. Sounds like Trump for some reason. He's a really nice person. Just try to distinguish these two. For some reason, this entire history was excluded from all of your texts everywhere, and I wasn't invited for an interviewer to tell about this group. It is so insulting that it was just erased.
An analysis through the framework of the negotiation suggests that in such cases, the potential interviewees are suspicious of the project's aims and therefore worry they might lose from the cooperation more than they could gain. In other cases, potential contributors to the archive shun from cooperation because of our project's publicity and visibility. These individuals would probably prefer to be interviewed anonymously by an academic than share their stories with a highly visible activist project that is clearly tied with the LGBTQ+ community. All that is true even though we make sure to offer our interviewees the option to share their stories without being recorded. One of our interviewees, for instance, agreed to be interviewed upon our first reach out to him, but as soon as we brought up the option of being filmed, he was alarmed and wanted to quit from participating. After several clarifications about the project's nature and the control he'd have over the level of exposure of his interview, he acceded to share his remarkable story. Another potential interview went through a similar course, but decided not to contribute his story eventually.
The second category of people who are absent from our archive are those of whose existence we do not know or do not know how to contact at all. This category is perhaps the more challenging of the two, as it marks the limits of both our knowledge and of queer activist research in our case. This category includes individuals who might be happy to participate in the project but were not exposed to it, or their names haven't come up in previous interviews, so it is impossible for us to reach out to them at the current stage. More importantly than that, also included in this category are individuals who we consider as potential interviewees, but they do not think of themselves as such. Notwithstanding our declaration that our archive accepts stories and materials concerning almost all types of people and identities, and even though we actively called for diverse participants, it is unlikely that everyone would feel that their stories are relevant or would want to share them with us. Such people might be those whose identity isn't defined by boxes offered by modern identity politics. Or those who feel that their sexual or gender identity isn't the pivot of their personality, or those who do not identify with the LGBTQ plus community. If we borrow the negotiation metaphor again, these individuals do not see any worth in what we are offering. This fact is especially frustrating since we believe that the history of sexual and gender diversity will not be complete without these narratives.
We shall now focus on this last group in the hopes of theorizing its members' choice not to participate in the project. To do so, we will use a theoretical framework suggested by the sociologist Dana Rosenfeld in her book, The Changing of the Guard. Rosenfeld dealt with the life stories and identity-building processes of elderly gays and lesbians. She coined the term identity career to represent the use of available discourse fields by referring them, applying them on oneself, or changing them, to build an individual's identity in the context of social categories and throughout time. Rosenfeld found that her interviewees' identity careers divide into two paradigms, correlating to the time when their sexual identity was formed and the sexual discourse available to them in this process. The first paradigm has to do with those whose sexual identity crystallized before the late 1960s, in a time of stigma and shame. These individuals tend to view their sexuality as an added layer rather than the pivot of their personality. Sorry. They might not consider themselves as gay or lesbian, and usually consider passing as straight as the preferable coping strategy and as a respectable way to lead one's life. The second paradigm is typical to the generation whose sexual identity developed after the late 1960s within the context of a more affirming discourse, at least within the gay and lesbian communities. These individuals tend to view their sexuality as the pivot of their personality, to adopt a gay or a lesbian identity, and to hold pride in coming out of the closet, which they view as a source for personal well-being and as well as a political strategy for the entire community.
Rosenfeld's work is rooted within the American history, in which the 1950s were the time of the Lavender Scare and the homophobic witch hunt of Senator McCarthy. The late 1960s, as opposed to that, were characterized by a substantial political action for civil and minorities' rights, especially after the Stonewall riots of 1969. Haifa's history is naturally different. Regrettably, we do not have the time to offer a local periodization. Nonetheless, we wish to utilize Rosenfeld's theoretical model for our own work. A significant part of our interviewees has a past and sometimes a present as activists. This is not surprising. Activism gets exposure, and it is probable that the names imprinted in history are those of activists. But this is an incomplete explanation. Following Rosenfeld, we believe that individuals who were exposed to activism as activism themselves or exposed to actions carried by others became aware to affirming depictions of the LGBT plus community or experienced belonging to a queer community in the formative years of their sexual identity, developed an affirmative identity and view coming out as meaningful, and vice versa. Individuals who grew up without the knowledge and language to explain their homosexual or bisexual desires, or those who grew up with stigma and shame, deprived of empowering concepts and acts of resistance, tend to opt for the career strategy of passing as straight. This reality existed in Palestine and Israel in certain times, but can also exist as a bubble in later periods, within more traditional communities or in communities with non-Western concepts of sexuality. Individuals who grew up in such environments will not likely identify as gay, lesbian, etc., and certainly won't identify as queer. To put it simply, our goods, the things that we're offering, have worth only for people who view their non-normative sexuality or gender as a basis for their identity and as a source of pride.
To conclude, this paper attempted in mapping the limits of our project's aspiration to include the most possibly diverse histories and life stories. We laid out several of these limits and tried to theorize them through the metaphor of the negotiation and through Rosenfeld's theory of identity careers. At this point, it would have been appropriate to suggest possible ways to overcome those limits. However, these problems remain unsolved in the heart of our work, albeit we have preliminary ideas of ways to overcome them. We believe other similar projects might face these challenges too. For this reason, we would prefer to finish with an invitation to, for a discussion of the possible solutions together. This conference is, after all, a rare opportunity to do so. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
So what we're going to do now is we're going to take two or three minutes where I ask you if you have anything that you thought was interesting about this session or anything you want to ask our speakers, to just discuss it with the people next to you, maybe see if you can formulate it into a question so that when we come to asking our panelists, we get really good questions that can be fed to all four of the people who've given you a talk this evening. Okay? So we'll take 3 minutes, just discuss with your pairs, and we'll get the speakers up on stage and we'll get comfy and set up here for you to be asking the questions. Okay, go. Okay, thank you very much. Let's regroup for a second here. All right, hello. Hello. Excellent. Members of the audience, thank you so much for your conversation. Hopefully, we have now some really lovely formulated questions that we'll be able to go to all members of our panel, so that we can engage in some discussion about their research and the things that they are presenting to us today. When you're asking a question, I would ask, please make sure it is a question, not a comment. We all know that feeling. It would be great if it was something that you felt would really build and improve the conversation that we're having here this evening. If it's something that you think you might want to discuss with just one of the members of the panel about their work or ways of improving or changing their research, I ask that you hold that and maybe talk to them afterwards, okay? This is a conversation for productive discussion to build on the papers that they're doing, not a place to be challenging and taking down the people who have kindly put themselves forward and discussed their work on our stage. I'll take hands and I'll ask people. We have a microphone so that anyone who is requires audio can hear. So if you pop up your hand and I'll invite you to come, and maybe we can actually just pass the microphone around. Is that okay? At the back, the technicians. Is it okay if we move the microphone? Yes, cool, fantastic. So maybe we'll do a case of passing the microphone around. So does anyone have a question that they would like to ask? If you pop your hands up, let's have a look. Can we have it up at the back there to start with? The microphone's in the middle. We'll pass it around.
So do we start?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you want to do maybe your name, if you like your pronouns, and then the question.
Okay. Hi, my name is Az. I come from Bosnia and Herzegovina, from Sarajevo. I am currently part of the Queer Archive Project in Bosnia, where we're documenting the stories from LGBTIQA persons from the war, from the 1990s, in the entire Yugoslav region. So my question is for the Queer Haifa. So I'm curious, have you witnessed a healing and transformative effect of your archive, given the occupation and everything that's going on in Israel and Palestine? Because from our experience, when we were doing it in Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia, we witnessed super strong political dimension of the archive and what it brings.
Yeah. We'll do answer.
That's an interesting question. Thank you. It's hard for me to answer. There's definitely a political dimension to the archive. Well, a dimension is maybe too small of a word. the archive is political, and definitely people, especially if they're Palestinian activists, bring these political agendas. But you were talking about like healing and reconciliation, and I'm not sure that it came up so much. But I'm not so familiar about the Balkan present, but I feel like you are more over your violent phase of the conflict. I don't know. Maybe I'm saying things that are wrong, but I feel like in Israel Palestine we are still like very much in the conflict. Then I'm not sure that we are in this phase of healing and reconciliation. Regrettably, I would love to say that our project helps in some way to kind of bridge between the nations and occupation. It doesn't. But I think we do sometimes can view through our work, especially Yoav's work, because his thesis deals with that. We can view specific cases where queer people kind of bridge these differences, and creating, for example, a trans community that has Palestinians and Jews together, or mixed couples of gay men or lesbian women that are now a trans man and a lesbian. So yeah, there's like specific instances. Maybe this is a start, the bud of an idea of how to use it. So thank you. You want to add something?
Yeah, just as Dotan mentioned, we're taking a political stance in this issue. And a part of it is that we are trying very hard not to pick a national narrative in our own work. We try not to take a side on that, but just tell stories that enable more complexity. And hopefully it might be used one day as part of healing, but unfortunately I don't think we have seen such a use so far.
Well, not picking sides, but at the same time really avoiding pinkwashing.
Just to open that to Brett and Yanar, do you have anything about using in these archives in reconciliation? If you do that. That's okay.
Well, from my perspective, there's an ongoing reconciliation effort in our country of Canada with colonial settlers and our Indigenous peoples. And obviously Two-Spirit people are included in that. The Two-Spirit community, I think, felt somewhat excluded from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission proceedings. So there's still a lot of work to do in Canada regarding reconciliation with our Two-Spirit people. And, you know, we're hoping that the archives might contribute in some way to that.
I mean, I'm not so sure if this question would be relevant for my work. Like, my work was not based on a conflict in Turkey. That's why I have no clever question now.
That's okay, don't worry. Down here at the front, if we can pass the microphone. I once went somewhere where they had a microphone you could throw, but I think that would be a bad plan in this case.
Hi, I'm Sebastian. I'm from the Freie Universität. I guess my question is kind of like, I see a connection, but maybe it's just in my head. So I'm originally from Canada, so like, thank you for your talk. I thought it was really, really interesting. But I was thinking also what you just said about healing and reconciliation. My original question would be to ask, how do you implement that in curriculum in a university? Because I think that's really interesting. But how also do you see how your work can be instrumentalized by the Trudeau government? So in a way, like, reconciliation is a beautiful concept of healing, but at the same time, it is used by this government to erase the ongoing colonial violence in Canada. So I was wondering if, like, this silence could also be instrumentalized in your archive. And I also had a question about the instrumentalization of silence for Yina. Thank you very much for your presentation. I also work on the Pink Triangle and negative aspect of the constructivist aspect of the Pink Triangle for gay identity and lesbian identities. And so I'm really interested into negative aspect of the past and how they're being used. And then so hearing about your work on negative forces and power dynamics, do you have example in your works about how queer groups in Turkey or Germany used those tabloids, so not only reacted to the power dynamics in order to get visibility, but actually decided, oh, we know that the Bild Zeitung is shit, so we're going to use it to make scandals, so that we're also going to go somewhere.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start with the first one, which I think was how to incorporate the archives into curriculum. So from our perspective, the first thing is just to get faculty and teachers aware, to make them aware of the existence of the archives is kind of our first step. Actively seeking out faculty on campus that, teach in relevant disciplines, so our gender and women's studies faculty, for instance, have already expressed an interest in making the Two-Spirit Archives part of their orientations for their students. So we're pretty excited about that. In all things with the Two-Spirit Archives moving forward, we're going to rely on the guidance and the leadership of our Two-Spirit Archives Advisory Council. So, the question will be posed in the next coming months, to get their wisdom and advice on how to do that appropriately. We also have an Indigenous advisory circle on campus that we also rely on their expertise and advice as well. Can you reformulate your question about the Trudeau and silence?
Well, I just feel that maybe that was not clear for people in the room also who are not from Canada. So there's this thing of like Canada always presenting itself as always like we're better than our neighbors in the south, but as this reconciliation became this idea of like, Trudeau goes in front of cameras, he cries a lot. This idea that our government goes in the media and has a beautiful photo hop saying like, oh, we are part of this reconciliation, we are all healing as a community. Also, coming from a white settler perspective, it's kind of weird to like center the discourse on the settlers, which is not the thing you're doing. Mm-hmm. But then there's this danger I feel that like all those reports and all those reconciliation committees are being used by the government to show how much a better nation we are now,
right,
and washing away the colonial violence that is still going on in many Indigenous communities across the country.
So. Right, yeah. It's important to acknowledge, from the outset that it is still ongoing and, it still is an issue. I completely agree with you that a lot of people in the room probably have a misconception of what the Canadian government, the Canadian government's relationship with Indigenous people. It's not all rosy, which is what the government is trying to project. So, I mean, the archives are, you know, the bastions of truth, and, you know, hopefully not just our archives, but archives across Canada in ongoing reconciliation efforts can, you know, use their archives to more clearly formulate the truth. I think that's the hope, anyway, of the Canadian archival system.
And, you know, there was a question about instrumentalizing the work from yours in silence.
Thank you very much for the question. Well, the most recurrent pattern is that the activists were mostly reacting and trying to create new forms of visibilities that did not exist in the public before, or trying to open up new spaces where they can, you know, share their stories. But from the 2000s on, some of the groups in Turkey also started using media or the tabloids as an instrument to disseminate their political views as well. As part of this was, for instance, the genetically modified tomato awards. I think it was like first introduced in 2005 by Lambda Istanbul, and it was an award for homophobic and transphobic well-known people. And because it has such a catchy name and the concept was catchy, all the tabloids started like making news about it. So they managed to change the typical power dynamics between, you know, the tabloids and the activists in another way.
All right, there was a question. Somebody else back here had a question. Yeah? Oh, yeah, okay.
Hi, I'm Pierrette Squires. My pronouns are she, her. I'm from Bolton Museum. I've got a question for you guys from Haifa. It was great that you mentioned about homosexual and bisexual identities when you were talking, but I noticed there's no bi representation in the oral histories you've collected. Is that something that, are there bi activists that you've been in touch with, you're aware of? Is it a community that's tough to tap into? How have you found that?
We find that getting people who identify as bisexual is quite tough, and we think that there's also a generational effect here. In many cases, in activist groups of gay men, bisexuality was considered a compromise or something. I mean, in past times, today I think that that would be obsolete. But we find that during the 80s and 90s, people who identified as bisexual were kind of excluded from most activist groups in Haifa. And in cases of women, we find that many women who are very active within the feminist community, within the lesbian community in Haifa, even though they had substantial periods in their life in which they had relationships with men, choose to identify mostly as lesbians. So in our case, we were kind of struggling to find people who identified as bisexual back then. And I don't know if it's a gap that we're able to bridge at the current moment.
I was wondering if you wanted, you know, to comment about visibility of particular people in the tabloid archives. I was wondering if you wanted, if you found that there was like this kind of the same thing where we seem to tend to get lesbian or gay visibility, but less maybe bi visibility in the tabloid archives.
Well, there's actually a very interesting difference between German and Turkish tabloids. So when you look at the German and Turkish archives, when you look at the Turkish archives, trans visibility becomes much more present than the German tabloids, for instance. It was most of the time the trans women who started the movement, and they were organizing the protests, so they become more visible. And they had also more problem with the state violence and with the police violence. So this pushed them into the realm of visibility. And we don't see a similar pattern, for instance, in the German archives. And there's also another difference, like when we talk about the lesbian visibility, it is much more present in the German archives, but not that present in Turkish archives. And we see also different identifications, like the idea of two different categories, like trans women and a gay man, did not exist in Turkey, or at least not in the archives, until the late 1980s and even early 1990s. So these two categories merged into one category, and it was called eşcinsel. The literal translation would be, like word by word translation would be homosexual. Like in the archives, in all this news, even trans women, they were defining themselves as with this category. So this changed like much later, like started like changing in the late 1980s, and I think this is like a difference that I observed between these two archives.
All right, we had a question down on the floor over here. Oh yeah, of course. Sorry, please into the microphone.
I just want to say that. Next to the questions, I want to repeat my invitation also to have like reflections about how to overcome limitations and boundaries of archives, ours, and of this sort. I think this can be very, very productive for us as a community of historians, librarians, archivists to think of these questions. Sorry.
Thank you. No, that's absolutely fine.
Hi everyone. My name is Hossein. I'm from Tunis, Tunisia. My question is for the HIFA project. We already exchanged a little bit during lunch about how you are trying to say that you're not like to stay away from the political agenda and from pinkwashing. So my question is, because I assume many Arabs from HIFA are very skeptical about pinkwashing and participating in that kind of agendas. So how do you communicate, how do you convince Arabs, Palestinians from HIFA to engage and share their stories in a safe space that is not pinkwashing? Like, for example, are you explicit about it, like that you are against pinkwashing? Like, for example, did you participate in the campaign?
Could you speak more slowly, please?
Okay. Did you participate in, the campaign against boycotting Tel Aviv Pride, for example? Are you explicit about that, this kind of opinions, and or you are trying to be very politically? How to say it, like, to satisfy everyone.
Neutral, politically neutral. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think us as individuals are definitely loud about our political views against the occupation and so forth. But as a project, we do not publicize, for example, in our Facebook page or whatever, a stance on this matter as a project. We do try very much to avoid from pinkwashing, and in the cases that we feel, for example, there was a newspaper article that was written about the first annual festival that we have. That says, like, the title was "For the First Time, the Middle East," and then, like, of course, portraying Israel as the most advanced country in the Middle East regarding these topics. So we did write in our Facebook page, like, our reservations. After the newspaper wouldn't include our reservations in the article, we used our platforms to publish our reservations. But I think also what we said about generational fault lines, I feel it. Maybe, I don't know if you agree, but I feel they also exist regarding Palestinian politics. So I feel that when we approach older Palestinian people from the queer community, they are more willing to share their stories with us, and with the younger people that are activists in Palestinian organizations for LGBT rights, like the younger generation of Aswat and Al-Qaws. These organizations are part of the BDS movement in different ways, and they have a harder time, or they're more suspicious, I'd say, to the project and of cooperating with us. It's, I would say it's a general problem, not only of us, but also of other like left organizations in Haifa, in Israel, when trying to kind of join the struggles, or it's complex. You want to add something?
Yeah. Just you were asking at the end what enables us to reach Palestinians, I think that's an okay phrasing. I think we have two things that really help us. First of all, we're a small volunteer group. Not supported by any big government or municipal funds. And this kind of helps distinguish us from any big political mechanism. And I think the second thing that helps us is that we're very local. We only tell the story of Haifa, and therefore we kind of have the privilege of not telling a national story, but telling a local story that can be mixed, intertwined, more complex, and has more colors to it. So I think we kind of play in that gap or crack between very hard notions.
And one last thing is for a while we did have a Palestinian member in the team, and this of course helped a lot also with the interviews themselves and like with the general politics. At the moment we don't have, but we definitely welcome. So if you know any Palestinian activists that want to be part of a history project, we will be delighted to welcome them into the project.
Can I ask why there's no Palestinian members now?
Because he's studying medicine and he had too much pressure with tests and studies.
No, but a part of him, I mean.
Guess from the same reasons that I mentioned before? No? Yeah?
Okay. Brett, I was wondering if you wanted to comment on maybe a similar issue with the Two-Spirit community. How do you convince them to value and contribute to your archive? What kind of methods are you?
From our perspective, it's important that they're involved in all capacities of the archive. So, through our council, we are having them lead the collection development of the collection. They have input in outreach. They have, they recommend donors. So really with every single aspect of the Two-Spirit archives, now Two-Spirit people are going to be leading the growth and development of that collection. And one of our goals is to also build archive and record keeping skills amongst the community, so that if members of the community don't feel like the University of Winnipeg is the most appropriate place for their records, they have the skills and the knowledge to be able to retain their own archives in their communities.
Fantastic. We probably have time for one or two more questions. Does anyone in the audience want to ask anything? We have a double, I have a question down here. Sorry, I know you've already asked a question. Perhaps you can find the panelists afterwards. Thank you. Sorry, a long way around with the mustache. Very well manicured mustache.
Hello, my name's Adam. So my question is mainly for Brett, but I see how it could connect to everybody, so I'll ask the question first and then maybe just kind of make connections. So based off of what you just said about wanting Two-Spirit Indigenous people to be able to, in a sense, sustain their own archives and have the knowledge to do that, is there any worry at all that sort of inducting Two-Spirit folk into archival practice, that through validating a digital archive as garnering recognition of humanity for any given group, would then sort of overshadow Indigenous mnemonic practices, and such that they might be lost, or that it would maybe promote more of an individualist view of knowledge over a communally dependent understanding of truth. So that, and then based on, I'm going to butcher your name, Yenna. I thought what you had to say about silence was really good. But I'm wondering, so is it enough to simply listen to the silence, or what ethical imperative comes out of the void? And then sort of for you two, in this sort of like generational divide between one group that wants to document and then another group who, you know, for whatever reason finds life easier to do things other ways, do you, like, what, to what end, I guess, is there this sort of desire to have these histories recorded for people that don't see it important for themselves?
So let's start at the end with Brett, and we can move down the panel.
Okay, I'm going to be quick in my response. I'll probably shorter the response than the question. I'm not concerned with that. You know, what we want to do is to create a collection that serves the needs of the Two-Spirit community. So, you know, if they are, you know, the community wants to apply certain methodologies and practices to the archive, and that's what helps the community the most, then, you know, we're all for that. That's our basic goal, is, you know, to help support the community in whatever way, you know, that manifests itself. So, you know, Two-Spirit people are Indigenous, and there are Indigenous ways of knowledge and methodologies, so you know, those translate to the Two-Spirit community as well. So you know, in many ways I don't see kind of a stratification, but you know, if those developed over time, I would be more than supportive of them.
Okay, a 1 minute answer, quick, okay, quick answer, so we can finish the panel.
Well, I definitely think that we need to listen more to the silence, and also start thinking about it, how we can analytically or theoretically grasp the silence. Because, like, one of the reasons why I started conducting this archive research was to see if all this activistic work left traces, like, in the public space, and I couldn't find anything. And so we need to think about not finding anything as well, because this is actually the most prominent or present when we talk about the histories of queers.
Also a 1 minute answer to the question, please, very short.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I have a really short answer. Like, the short answer is, like, we want to know the history, and I think, like, we can have a long philosophical discussion about what is this desire, like you quoted Heather Love, what is this desire to know history. But I feel that knowing history is a major part of our activism as a community. We kind of felt that our community in Haifa, people in the community always felt like Haifa is like they compromise living in Haifa and not in Tel Aviv, where all the gay life, all this nonsense. And we kind of wanted to show that queer life has been lived in Haifa, and they are lived in Haifa now, and they will be lived in Haifa in the future, and they are diverse, they are interesting, they are exciting, and this is the reason we want to get to the bottom of these stories. Of course, we cannot and do not want to force anyone to be more visible than they feel that they want, but I think what we were trying to present here is that we think some of these some of the fears that they have are not rooted in the actual practices of the archive. Like, they can stay relatively invisible and still contribute their stories in a meaningful way. And we are thinking of ways how to kind of, you know, hold the stick in both ends.
Okay, so we'll pause there, and if you have further comments, we can take this up after the discussion. Because we are all going to go to supper, which I'm sure is going to be fantastic and delicious, but just a reminder that at 8 p.m. this evening, there is the theatre play, The Einstein of Sex, which is happening in Livingston's cabinet. And until then, enjoy your supper. A round of applause, please, for our panelists. Thank you all for being here.